Top Med Talk.
Well, hello and welcome to the show. It's Top Med Talk, and we are here at Euroanesthesia 2024 in Munich, Germany. It's the annual congress of the European Society of Anesthesiology and Intensive Care. Now, I'm Desiree Chappell. I'm your host, and joining me today is Kate Leslie from Melbourne, Australia.
A long way from Munich, Germany.
That's right. And I was like, yes, Melbourne, all the way up here. Thanks for joining us again. You were just in Australia several weeks ago doing Top Med Talk Down Under.
We had a great time. We did 17 interviews. They're all on the website and the app. And we did sustainability and global health and chronic pain and leadership.
Yeah. You and Andy Cousty did us proud.
Oh, well,
it was amazing.
We weren't like the original and the best, Desiree, but we tried our best.
It was awesome. You guys were fantastic. Thank you so much. Kate, without the support and partnership with organizations like ANSCA before and this meeting, the European Society of Anesthesiology and Intensive Care, we wouldn't be able to do Top Med Talk. So we just wanted to give a huge thank you to that organization for supporting us to be here in the exhibit hall having these fantastic conversations. So thank you so much. And we couldn't do this without the generous support of our sponsors. They keep Top Med Talk free and open access to the globe. All these wonderful conversations, anyone can listen to them at any time. So thank you to them. Kate, without further ado, I think we need to introduce our next guest.
We do. We're very privileged to have Wolfgang Wu, who's the president of ASIAC. I never get that right. Maybe you could tell us how to pronounce it and also tell us a bit about yourself, Wolf.
Well, thank you, Kate. It's a pleasure to have you here. You're one of 151 Australian colleagues which found their way to Munich. So we're extremely happy that...
Is there any beer left in Munich?
Everything is available to make Australians happy here. So, Wolfgang Wu, I'm the president of the ASIAC, as you told, and my other party or my other job is to be the chair of the Department of Perioperative Medicine in Utrecht in the Netherlands.
Yeah. So Wolf is a Top Med Talk fave. He's been on the show several, a couple of times now. It's been wonderful. I'm so glad you came back. Thanks for coming to chat with us.
It's my pleasure.
Yeah.
Because I like that format. It's a conversation. It allows us to reach a lot of colleagues all over the globe with very basic communications. And I always get a very little feedback from them.
Well, our next guest, we have Carol Romero. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. My name is Carol. I come from Spain and this is my first time here. So never been in Top Med before, but I think this was a good format to broadcast this idea.
So tell us, Wolf, a little bit more about ASIAC. ASIAC. Tell us how to pronounce it.
ASIAC.
It's that.
Quite simple. Well, basically, ASIAC is the European organization or society for perioperative medicine plus intensive care medicine. And in contrast to other countries in Europe, intensive care is much more related to anesthesia. I know the college in Australia is quite different from us. So we try to cover all areas of anesthesia, work closely together with a lot of our specialist societies. There's also a European Society of Cardiothoracic Anesthesia, Pediatric Anesthesia, etc. Classical way, and we consist of members. We are a member organization. But we are also relatively closely related to 43 national societies. So when we start this Congress, we have always two business days. One is the business days with our members from all over Europe. And the other day is the day with all the national societies. And then the party starts and approximately 5,000 people are coming to the Congress.
Yeah, I was going to ask to see what the attendance been this year.
I don't have the
final count, of course.
The final count. I think it's approximately 25 to 30% more than last year in Glasgow. Okay. It's still a hybrid form. So we have the Congress face-to-face here, but we also have a hybrid part of it, which is, I think we will have approximately 900 to 1,000 people in the hybrid part and 4 to 5 here. That's a bit the story.
Yeah, that's great. We're getting back to life after AC after COVID.
Oh, we certainly are. And what are the general fields of endeavor of ASIAC?
Well, normally ASIAC covers a lot of the classical tracks of education first. The second one is we have a relatively strong research track, which is represented by the Clinical Trial Network of the European Society. we invested last year in guidelines. I think Carol will elaborate on that. And then year after year, we have a couple of strategic topics. Last year, we introduced sustainability. The strategic topic of this year is connectivity in the broadest sense, and also try to establish one learning track throughout a year. And this year, it was the brain, everything which has to do with the brain.
And you also publish the European Journal of Anesthesiology?
Yes.
Or you oversee its publication?
Yeah, it's the European Journal is our journal with a classical form and an open access form nowadays. And yeah, we had that meeting because the editor-in-chief is part of the board of ESAIC. And we are developing together with him also some new ideas about the journal, which is also part of the Congress.
And what's it like being the president of ESAIC?
Beautiful.
Beautiful.
Yes.
Golly.
I've heard party a lot. Like, that's a very European. I love it.
Why do you like it?
Well, I'm grown up in the research part of ESAIC, and I started in scientific committees. I have the opportunity to help to improve the research committee and develop the clinical trial network. I think the last part of research was to start up the research mentorship program. So I was always very closely connected to the wonderful world of research. And as my research is primarily based on outcome, what really creates patient value in perioperative medicine, it is quite logical that you're also interested in education, examination, and the possibilities of creating, let's say, recommendations and guidelines to help the public. At a certain moment, you know that from different roles in Australia you had, is you are asked to take over some responsibility. So a couple of time ago, they asked me if I may be interested to do that. And I thought a bit about it. And I said, when the team is good, what I know on before from research, and when I'm able to ask a couple of people to help, then you can create a leadership team which is able to do it. And because we have that team, it's beautiful. And not so stressful as some people assume.
It must be wonderful to create something, and in particular, the new guideline stream, Caroline. So how did that arise, and what is the process for developing new guidelines?
So for me, it's also really a very, very important job that we have in our society, because I'm always a research person, but I mainly focus in biostatistics and how to improve statistics in medicine. Usually my perspective is that doctors, we don't get out of the hospital really often. We're always doing clinical work. So it's really difficult to meet, for example, engineers or statistics. So other people are doing different work with new, let's say, statistic methods, or not new, but a little bit more difficult to ask for understanding. So I started like this, like doing new methods of statistics in my research or using new methods. And then now I focus to doing a little bit of meta research and mainly evidence-based research. So my perspective and my project for the guidelines committee is to grow and to include many other stakeholders that are important to create robust guidelines with good methodology, and then we can use these guidelines to treat our patients, giving the best treatments, because who doesn't want to do that, right?
So in the past, a lot of society and college guidelines were based on so-called expert opinion. Yes. Bringing your statistics and research expertise to the role, are you trying to make them more evidence-based?
Yes, that could be the idea, but actually sometimes a little bit difficult, because I think that also doctors and sometimes all colleagues, they keep to maintain this kind of power, deciding what we have to do and telling others what they should do, thinking that their experience is more important than the evidence, right? So I could say that we are trying to move to that. Obviously, for doing that, we need primary research. That's why it's so important that we create good research. Then the other thing that goes together is to be more transparent, to try to reproduce our guidelines and to avoid this part of conflicts, because we are plenty of cognitive bias. Or every time when we make a decision, We have already have this decision in our mind before we speak our brain, because somebody, there was Victoria Metassa that was precisely talking about how we make decisions. And actually, there is a good conversation about this. I don't know if you know the fight between the battle between frequentist and Bayesian analysis.
So for our listeners, this is between traditional statistical yes. methods and so-called Bayesian methods. And I'm not going to say any more about that because I don't think I can explain it. Okay. But in any case...
Yes, a small quote from a friend, a mathematician. He said that even doctors, we are Bayesian, even if we don't know it. Because Bayesian is when every time we do a frequentist analysis, meaning using the traditional p-values, we don't use any of the evidence that has been produced before. It's like the first time you see an experiment, you see a treatment, you don't use anything that you know before. And that's not what we do. That's not what humans do. Humans, we make decisions based on our experience.
Mm.
Could you imagine that? Mm. That we are Bayesian without even knowing.
So what's your favorite ESA guideline?
I feel like I can't answer that because that will put me in a very difficult situation to pick one.
What are some recent guidelines that are maybe rolling out during the meeting this year or that have rolled out recently?
This year, we've published 3 guidelines so far on the management of cardiac arrest. We are going to launch another update on venous thromboembolism prophylaxis with 10 international societies. That was led precisely by the editor-in-chief, Marcel Melma.
The EJA.
The EJA, yeah. There's the new guideline on the preoperative evaluation. That this is a very huge topic, a very important topic. So compared to the previous guideline, we didn't update all chapters. We just focused on some evidence, some new evidence in new chapters. So we are still keeping some parts of the old guideline that are still valid. And we are just focusing in the things that have changed, right? Because we can repeat the work endlessly if there is anything new. So we also have to be sustainable in that, right?
As you said, first of all, guidelines need to have the highest methodological standard. There's a lot of improvement in the past years with respect to the underlying grade schemes. Second, they need to have a chance to get implemented into clinical practice. Third, I think, at least as you said, we always have to find the balance between what is the most important for our community. And what we heard is that preoperative evaluation is still one of the most important topics. We know that thromboembolism, giving all the new drugs and cardiology, etc., is a hot potato, a hot item. And you have to remember, we need to offer these guidelines for at least 43 countries in Europe, but also a couple of countries outside Europe, and the WFSA is asking for that. So it also needs to have some universal approach.
It makes it difficult, doesn't it? Because, for example, your neuromuscular monitoring guideline, which is a terrific document that I've read closely, it recommends the use of quantitative neuromuscular monitoring and also the reversal agent Sugammadex. And these things are not readily available to patients in probably 80% of the anesthetics given worldwide. But that doesn't mean that you should not be putting them in a guideline.
I agree with you, and I was going to answer also with an example. I'm sure that you also know that many of the guidelines recommend to eat, I don't know, 3-4 pieces of fruit per day. However, in many countries, that's not possible. So, I mean, obviously, it's not always possible to give the best treatment for everybody. So there is another kind of science within the guidelines that is called implementation. So we will give what we consider that is the best standard, and then you have to adapt and implement those parts of the guidelines that are feasible. Because guidelines also have this mission of considering what are the interventions that are more important, let's say, so you can rationalize resources, because resources now are very limited, not only related to staff, but also to drugs and to many other things. So it's a way of helping us in deciding which kind of treatments we can't spare because they prove to be very efficient.
Yeah. And all of it, it's a worldwide thing, as you said. I mean, for many guidelines recommending things that if you don't have resources, and this is not, I mean, there are countries that definitely are under-resourced, but even countries that consider well-resourced, we don't have access to a lot of those as well. So it's really important to be aspirational, but have implementation science as well.
It's an important point because it took us years to learn how diverse possibilities are worldwide. And for me to be part of the WFSA Congress, the World Congress in Singapore, it opened my eyes, to be honest. Because the discussions we had on global health, the metrics we need to apply to serve the WHO to get the system of perioperative medicine into their basis metrics is quite important. And what we get back also here in Munich is basically we have to reinvent the specialty a bit. I know the numbers from my country quite well. Every year we will most likely have 6 to 10% more patients and 6 to 10% less caregivers. That means when looking for 5 years, the amount of patients increased by 30%, the amount of caregivers will decrease by 30%. And we simply will not have the people which can do that work in the old style. So there are a lot of challenges in getting things done, and the challenges are quite close. That's one of the reasons why we have the Innovation Village as a new format where we bring a lot of people together from industrial partners, different societies. Next year we will have patients, we will have policymakers, because as we learned in Singapore that we have to look worldwide with respect to perioperative medicine, we will learn to be much more active to create a triangle of medical knowledge, industrial partners, authorities, and the patient in the center of that, because that's it's all about.
Desiree chaired a really good session at the World Congress where you interviewed 4 leaders of healthcare industry technology companies in a discussion about these very issues. That was about sustainability and about the increasing burden of health and about what they were going to do about getting their products in to help patients in other countries.
Yeah, we have to have these conversations going forward. I think we've always tried to silo ourselves working together. There are so many questions and so many issues that are coming up that we face in anesthesia. We have to partner with industry and patients. I love the fact that you are bringing patients in and figure out how all of this intertwines, that interconnection, to make sure that whatever technology is being developed out there to help us do our jobs better and in a more efficient way, it's one, what the patient actually needs, and then 2, what we as clinicians, how we use them. And that was a big takeaway for me during that session.
So what the ASI did, and we just started it shortly before the Congress, we know that we get all these information that things needs to be changed. So we said, okay, that means also that besides research, education, examination, guidelines, and the Congress, we really need to develop some idea of advocacy for the specialty, which for you is quite new because in Europe, healthcare was always a national business. And one of the lessons from COVID or in the post-COVID period is that the European Union or the European community takes over much more because we have learned one thing, even the best healthcare systems are not able to solve it alone. So we started that approach, which is for us quite new. It will be one of the primary targets of the second year of my presidency, besides outcome and connectivity, to put a lot of energy into that because it's a totally different approach, taking perioperative leadership in an environment like the European Commission and health policymakers.
So what sort of issues would you envisage taking to the European Commission?
Basically, we have 3 areas. The first area is indeed the availability and non-availability of goods.
drugs and equipment.
Drugs and equipment. And also in Europe, we have an extremely strong medical device regulation system, which has caused a lot of issues because it was not very well prepared at the starting point. The second one that we really need to know is, in our opinion, connectivity of data to follow the patient through the pathway is quite crucial. So I think this will be a very intense discussion with the European Commission, how to organize that in so many countries.
It's because it's so difficult to get any kind of data at all, right, about patients, no matter what system it's coming from.
On the other way, I think for the specialty, it's quite vital to create something like a European perioperative database. We just started one of these programs with a group of scientists funded by the EU Commission for ICU, which is the easy part of it.
Yes.
And we try to learn how can we organize that for the big burden of perioperative, because when having that data, when being able to predict on this level, we absolutely have additional value for the resource planning for everything we need.
And probably to combine both at that one point, because some of the patients from the perioperative will go to the ICU, right? Yes. That could be fantastic.
Yes.
I just want to add that I'm also very fond of advocacy, because I think that usually doctors, we speak a jargon and we are not able to communicate to others, lay people, policymakers, what we do. So we don't present our value. So advocacy for me is really, really important. How we communicate to patients, also to get disabilities, in order to inform them correctly about their options of treatment. That's why we have to keep the patient at the center and to be able to speak in a lay word what their options are, so they can choose the best option, let's say.
Sounds like you've put a lot of strategy into this. One of those things that I've heard a lot about too is the mentorship.
I'm actually the third mentorship program leader. After me, before me was Wolfgang and then Claude. So I'm actually a byproduct of this society. I was a mentee during COVID times, and I made my application twice. The first time I wasn't selected, so I applied a second time during COVID, and I was also pregnant at that time, I think, but I got selected. So for me, it was a life-changer situation. I had a beautiful mentor from Italy, and we really did well during those 2 years. I learned a lot. It's really good to have somebody else from outside your environment with you, with whom you can talk to and learn from. So I think it's really important, this program, because it gives the opportunity for junior person, when I was at that time, to grow and to become a better person, a better scientist, and then to continue the work collaborating. So since I'm taking this role, I saw how many mentees have grown out with this program, and they are still friends with the mentors. We have precisely tomorrow the kickoff meeting of the mentorship programs. For this meeting, we have invited a pair of mentor and mentees. They won't know that they are going to meet again together.
Aww.
So it's going to be a surprise. And let's say it's a really active program. I think people are really happy, and also give the opportunity to senior leaders to transfer the knowledge, because this is a really important mission, to share what you know. What do you think about that, Wolfgang?
I cannot agree more. No. I think the primary idea was that it helps enormously in the development of an individual if there's somebody outside your institution, outside your usual pairs in another country, mentees you. And I think at the beginning, we were absolutely surprised about the number of people applying, but also, as Carol said, it's building a relationship. And in particular, those colleagues more or less in a late stage of their career, for them, it's like somebody told me it's my third spring, because that's the beauty of sharing knowledge and expertise, as you said it.
And I think that also mentees, they give away so much knowledge to their mentors, because they help them with new technologies, artificial intelligence, new methods. So I think it's a kind of symbiosis. it makes a special relationship because at the end, you get to discuss many things that you want to discuss with other person because you may be as shy. So you can think out of the box. You can share your crazy ideas for research. And then who knows, one day you get with the perfect idea, you write a grant, and then you get funding and then everything goes boom. So I think it's one of the most fresher projects probably that we have. And then so many mentees become part of the research network at the SAIC. And we saw yesterday them in the research and guidelines reception, yeah. Right?
And that's what I was just going to ask that question. So the focus on the mentees, are they junior doctors and this is a mentorship just in general for anesthesia and perioperative medicine, or is this more focused around research?
It's just focused around research. Okay. I mean, we have other projects, programs at SAIC that the name's the clinical, that is the training exchange program, for example. But this is mainly focused in research because they work in different countries.
Yeah.
So sometimes not easy to learn clinical skills, but the idea is to write together papers, to do studies, learn about methodology, statistic, how to publish, whatever. So I think it's a really nice opportunity. I think many other big countries also have these kind of projects, like in the US, I don't know, the case of Australia.
Yes,
probably.
Right. Yeah, research mentorship is alive and well at the College of Anaesthetists in Australia and New Zealand.
So I think it's also a really vital part of a medical society to collaborate this way between the juniors and the seniors.
We have, I think this year we have the highest number of receptions ever. And because a congress is something where you share knowledge and you meet friends, old friends and new friends and everything else. But beside that, also people with a shared interest can meet. And they organize everything on their own. People who are dedicated to education, to guidelines, to research, we only have to give them the space and they fill in with connectivity. And that's, I think, what makes such a congress interesting. I'm not in favor of making everything in accordance to all the learning tracks. We have them and we need them, and that's important for CME accreditation. But to let a lot of space for ideas which can be covered within that environment is, I think, also one of the usual parts of uroanesthesia. Well, I think it's leadership. In our opinion, momentarily, I think it means a lot. It's listening, be open, and be available, and to make some decisions at a certain moment. And I think that's something which is important, at least for us momentarily, to give that space to allow people to create their developments. In Europe, traditionally, we don't have that fellowship scheme, as you know, from the Royal College in different countries. And that's indeed something which I discussed with my colleagues from the Royal College in Australia as well as in the UK. There are some elements of the college system, the fellowship system, which is very positive for the development of the specialty in these early years. So indeed, we are thinking about, should we develop a couple of programs for young staff members to take special attention of?
We were talking in one of our podcasts in Australia about that issue, is that we provide leadership training to people who are at the end of their vocational training in anaesthesia. And then there are things like MBAs and stuff that people do later on. But there's the bit in the middle where young leaders are not sure how to develop their leadership skills and where to go to learn about different things and where to get opportunities to lead small things that lead to big things. And I think Carol is a great example. You put your hand up for one thing and all of a sudden you're the chair of the guideline committee.
Well, I wouldn't say that it's almost suddenly. It didn't occur suddenly because I've been engaged for more than 10 years in society, attending master class, and then as a junior methodologist, mentee, many, many things. But I think that what you meant probably is that being engaged, being present, being available, and also being a team player and delivering the work, it actually makes a difference. then things happen when you know how to work with people and when you have skills communicating. So this can happen, and I'm an example of that, that hard work and also a good character probably gets around you.
Well, on that note, because I think that's all very positive and wonderful, I love listening to this and the work that's being done, the fellowship and the space for creativity and development is very important. So congratulations to you guys. Wolf, congratulations on your presidency, which sounds like you're about a quarter of the way through. That's what we just said. Yes. You got some time left.
We should make also another interview at the end of your presidency to then compare what's your mood level and if it's stabilized or if it drops.
It depends on you.
I know.
And some others.
But that's average wage win. We need to know how much. It depends on me. It's only you.
Wow. I'm quite optimistic because you just mentioned that I had the opportunity to have a wonderful leadership team training throughout my career. And at the end, it will fit.
There you are. Yeah, that's sure. Great. Well, thank you guys so much for taking the time out. I know it's a super busy conference for you. You're on to your next thing. I appreciate it. We appreciate it here on Top Med Talk.
Bye. Cheers.
Thank you. Med Talk. Thanks for downloading Top Med Talk. Don't forget to subscribe. Check us out on YouTube and, of course, on social media. We're on Instagram, Facebook, and X. Also, it's important to remember that Top Med Talk is the broadcasting arm of EPOM, evidence-based perioperative medicine. We'd love you to find out more about that, and the way to do that is epom.org. Check out our website and find out about some of the incredible conferences we're going to be arranging across the year. epom.org.